On this week's 51%, Donald Trump has been elected the 47th President of the United States, defeating Vice President Kamala Harris in this month's general election. We'll go over the results with Ange Marie Hancock, a political science professor from The Ohio State University.
What Kamala Harris was asked to do was nearly impossible, just statistically speaking, was nearly impossible to do.
In some states, abortion was literally on the ballot this year in the form of various ballot proposals. We'll take a look at how some of those measures performed with voters. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Alita. I wasn't really in it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Donald Trump will once again be president of the United States. The Republican defeated Vice President Kamala Harris in a general election that largely favored GOP candidates. In addition to winning the White House, they also flipped the Senate. And at the time of this taping, anyway, Republicans currently lead in the House. It could be days or weeks before we know for sure which party will in fact control the House next year. But for the second time in the last three presidential elections, Americans have chosen Trump over a woman candidate. And for some women, this might sting even more than when Trump beat Hillary Clinton in 2016, because now he's got January 6th, two impeachments, criminal charges, sexual abuse allegations, and a felony conviction under his belt. Harris, the first Black and South Asian woman to earn the Democratic nomination for president, conceded the race the day after polls closed with a speech at her alma mater, Howard University.
While I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign.
Today we're going to do our best to debrief the results, given the information that we have. And what better way to do that than catching up with Ange Marie Hancock, political expert and executive director of the Kirwan Institute at The Ohio State University. Hancock also leads a consortium of scholars known as the Kamala Harris Project, studying Harris's tenure as the first woman vice president. We first spoke with Hancock over the summer when Harris became the Democratic nominee, and there was a lot of excitement around that time. But obviously, that did not pan out 100 days later.
I think there were lots of moments in the last 100 days where folks who were supporting the Harris campaign, Democrats, folks who were anti-Trump, you know, kind of that whole collection of folks, allowed themselves to believe that this was not the steep uphill battle that it actually was. There were folks that could get peeled off that really don't care about the impact that this election is now going to have on women and people who get pregnant across the entire country. So the way that I've been talking about it with friends has been, you know, 100 or so days ago, Kamala Harris was essentially asked to draw an inside straight in poker. And if you play poker, you know that you have about an 8.5% chance of getting an inside straight in poker. The other 91.5% is you're not going to get an inside straight, right? And I think, again, because of the strength of the campaign that she ran, and I think the genuine impacts of the fall of, you know, Roe v. Wade, and the success that had been had at the state level and getting those ballot measures passed, there really was a sense that she could sort of draw on that momentum and put things over the top.
You mentioned that some of the voter base basically got peeled off, I think are the words that you used there. I know, you know, we're still seeing exit polls and still kind of figuring things out at the point of our conversation right now. But from what you're seeing, you know, which voters were peeled off in this race?
So we did see a clear and consistent gender gap, which I don't think anyone was going to be surprised by. I think some folks were surprised by the magnitude, right? So you had 20% of Black men, for example, vote for Donald Trump. And I think, you know, the Harris campaign was looking for numbers that would be more akin to what Barack Obama got, you know, in 2008 and 2012, because the only difference between the two of them is, you know, gender, for example, right? That was something that was, you know, somewhat surprising. There was also, the Trump campaign was also able to peel off a lot of Latino voters as well. And again, many more men than women on that front as well. Maybe a little less surprising because there might be a little more social conservatism in Latino communities than there are in Black communities. But I think the fact that there was a successful kind of, peeling off of those voters who were willing to vote for Joe Biden in 2020, perhaps, in the Latino or the Black male community, and have them instead vote for Trump, I do think was evidence of folks who were, not that they weren't concerned about the economy, but they were willing to put the concerns about the economy over the health and lives of the women in their lives. And I thought that was pretty surprising to me.
I guess, is there anything that the campaign could have done more to prevent the peeling off of those voters? And I don't know, I feel like over the course of the next few weeks slash months for the foreseeable future, we're going to be hearing a lot of analyses about, what could have happened, what should have happened, what could have been done, what should have been done. And, I feel like there's two different conversations that I'm seeing happening in my circles right now, is this sort of like, what could have Kamala Harris done to make herself appeal more to these voters? But also, does it even matter? At the end of the day, she's a woman candidate, a woman of color candidate. And is the US not even really ready to elect its first woman president? I don't want to say that because there were losses for Democrats pretty much across the board from what we've seen so far. But I don't think it's not a factor either. So I'm curious, I think I had brought this up to you over the summer as well. It's just like, is America just not ready?
Yeah, and I think two things can be true at the same time, right? So if I had, and I really don't have a lot of criticism of the campaign, if I had one question of the campaign, I think there was one ad that did not seem to get made. And I have not seen every single campaign ad on the face of the planet, but I have not seen it. There was one campaign ad that did not seem to get made, and that was the ad that talked about the fact that 300,000 people in the United States of America died between March 2020 and December 2020 of COVID, right? Like, no one actually voiced that or said that as, something that would disqualify a candidate like Donald Trump from ever being president again. There were lots of, kind of things around COVID, what we inherited, or, things that have been done since then to kind of re-energize the economy. But there was never any 300,000 Americans who will never go to another high school graduation, never attend a child or a sibling's wedding, never, kind of get that dream job that they had always wanted. Like, that will not happen for those 300,000 folks. And so if I had a question for the campaign, it would really be, why not that ad? Right. And I'm sure they'll tell me it did not test well or some other explanation, but I think that was the thing that seemed to never get mentioned in this election cycle. So the second thing I would say is that we do, as the United States of America, need to have a conversation about our unwillingness to elect people as qualified as either Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris for the presidency of the United States. Particularly when the person they were running against was so dramatically disqualified and unqualified for the role, whether you look at felony convictions, whether you look at level of education, even whether you look at things like breadth of government experience or business experience, right? These two women, each on their own, had incredible credentials to lead this country. And each time there were men in different segments of our community, who helped tip the balance towards Donald Trump.
Well, what is it going to take then? Or do you worry that we're going to get to this point where women presidential candidates are considered too risky?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely the case, and I think part of the reason why I like to remind people about why what Kamala Harris was asked to do was nearly impossible, just statistically speaking, was nearly impossible to do. Is because I don't want it to be an argument about electability going forward. One of the things that we can do as we think about, how do we get to that level of conversation is we really are going to yes, be very disappointed, even if we're not surprised about, the outcome that happened in the 2024 election. But we do not have the luxury of kind of wallowing in that disappointment. I do think it is going to require a renewed effort in cultural transformation and a recognition of just how hard it's going to be going forward. I think in each case, we lost sight of just how hard this glass ceiling is in the United States. I think we kind of assumed in 2016 with former Secretary Clinton that we would have this moment where, of course, we're going to pick this incredibly talented and qualified woman over the character of Donald Trump. And we're highly disappointed when that did not happen, right? So I think there was a disillusionment there. And then again, this year, even though the circumstances were very, very difficult to actually have the Democratic candidate win this election in the form of Kamala Harris, we actually lost sight because she ran such a strong campaign. We lost sight of just how difficult what we were asking her to do actually is. And so I think, again, we really want to think about the level of cultural transformation we're going to have to do.
I think it's worth pointing out too that, I mean, this wasn't like an election where there was a total gender divide. I mean, there were a lot of women, and specifically white women, who voted for Trump as well. And, they did in 2016, they did in 2020. I guess, what do you make of that?
So when we're thinking about suburban white women voters, one of the things that we need to kind of recognize is there is also a broader swath of the American voting public that is in search of very protective forms of leadership. So many would call them patriarchal forms of leadership, but there are folks who want, more of a this person is going to protect me or is going to come up with, policies that will protect me. And I think that can mean anything from, literally public safety kinds of policies, but also it can mean economic policies as well. And so I think when we think about what happened in this particular election, we will again see that there were challenges there, even as there was a shift in terms of, very intentional organizing, around that intersectional identity.
Well, Ashmarie, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. And the analysis that we've seen so far on the election, is there anything that you feel like is missing from that conversation or an angle that we're not looking at and should be?
So I want to go back to COVID just for a second, to really talk about what I think the United States has been going through over the past 2 years. I was talking with my team earlier this morning about the election results, and I'm not an expert in psychology or social work, but one of the things we do know about how PTSD works is that it does have an impact on memory. And I think, if we were to extend this analogy to kind of think about society at large in the United States, we all endured the trauma of COVID-19 ravaging our communities, and basically transforming every aspect of our lives for, the years of 2020 and 2021 at a minimum. But what's been interesting in how I've seen this campaign unfold on both sides is that there's been no real kind of grappling with those first 9 months. It's almost as if voters who are giving Trump credit for the economy don't really have anything to say about March 2020 through December 2020. And then they kind of like woke up in 2021 and gas prices and all other kinds of prices started to rise. And there was, incredible inflation that needed to be addressed and attacked by the Fed, right? So it's kind of they remember 2018, 2019, then 2020 just kind of drops out of their consciousness. And then they pick up again at 2021 and 2022 when inflation hit its peak. And I think, again, the Democratic campaign did not kind of pick up on that and remind folks about what those 9 months were really like, and what the economy was really like at that time. And I think, again, those are the kinds of things that, end up allowing that trauma and that traumatic moment, really to not be attributed to the people or the person who was responsible for why we endured that trauma in the first place.
I wanted to ask as well, you know, you're the lead curator of the Kamala Harris Project, a consortium of scholars studying Harris's tenure as the first woman vice president. How will this be factoring into the studies and research that you're doing?
Well, we certainly are still planning on continuing the Kamala Harris Project. I should say that first and foremost. What she has been able to do over the past 3.5 years, now going into her fourth year, has been history, right, in real time. And so we definitely will continue with that. I am certain that when we host our next symposium, which will be in May of 2025, there will be articles and papers that will address the campaign itself, as well as, you know, kind of social media and media kinds of engagements with VP Harris. And then I think there will be some reckoning with really how to think about how some of these intersectional groups continue to support systems that keep women free of their rights, if that makes sense, right? So rather than having their rights, they actually stop those rights from being able to protect them.
Anj Marie Hancock is a professor of political science at The Ohio State University and the executive director of its Kirwan Institute. She's also the curator of the Kamala Harris Project, a consortium of scholars studying Harris's political career and tenure as the first woman vice president. You can learn more about her work at osu.edu. Abortion rights were a major issue this election cycle, and for 10 states, abortion was literally on the ballot in the form of various ballot proposals. Many of these measures sought to enshrine abortion rights in state constitutions. How successful were they, and what does that mean for the ever-changing landscape of abortion rights in the U.S.? Well, to learn more, I spoke with Elizabeth Smith, Director of State Policy at the Center for Reproductive Rights.
Of the 10 proactive constitutional amendments on the ballot this November, some of them are specific to abortion rights and some are broader and are about reproductive freedom. The abortion-specific measures were in Arizona, in Colorado, in Florida, in Montana, in Nebraska, and in Nevada and South Dakota. The broader measures specific to reproductive freedom were in Maryland and Missouri. And then in New York, there was a ballot initiative that protects against discrimination based on different identity types, including pregnancy outcomes, pregnancy loss, et cetera. So while abortion is part of all of the 10, it is either a single subject or part of a larger set of protections.
Are there any ballot measures that stick out to you, whether they're, you know, particularly unique or a pretty big deal for their state specifically?
Looking across the 10, some of these constitutional amendments were on the ballot in states that currently enforce abortion bans. So thinking about Missouri, for instance, in the state of Missouri, there has been a total abortion ban essentially since Dobbs. So, you know, no healthcare, no abortion care available in the state. The Missouri total abortion ban, like many of the other total abortion bans, does have exceptions. But as, you know, the center's litigation in Texas and other states has demonstrated, the exceptions don't work. So essentially, people in Missouri went to the polls having spent 2+ years under a total abortion ban where care isn't available. And 54% of them voted yes on Amendment 3. And so, you know, going forward, the Missouri Constitution will be amended and implementation work is necessary. None of these amendments are self-executing, but Planned Parenthood has already stated plans to file litigation to ensure that the rights that will be in the Missouri Constitution are felt in the lived experience of folks in Missouri.
And so for some of these other ballot measures, how did they pan out? Which ones passed and which ones didn't?
To start with a little historical perspective, even though that's funny, we're talking about the last 2.5 years. Prior to this week, abortion had won every time it had been on the ballot. So we came into this week with 7 wins across, you know, states that look pretty different from each other, like California, Kentucky, Kansas, Vermont, Michigan, Ohio. Of the 10 that were on state ballots this Tuesday, 7 of them were successful. And again, we are talking about states that are pretty different from each other. So Arizona, Colorado, Maryland, Missouri, New York, Montana, Nevada, and 3 of the amendments were not successful. And those were the amendments in North Dakota and in Nebraska, and unfortunately in Florida. In Florida, 57.1% of voters supported Amendment 4, but that they didn't get over the threshold of 60% that's required in that state to amend the Constitution. But I would like to say that the campaign in Florida did incredible work. They filed almost 1 million signatures to get on the ballot. They got through review by one of the most conservative state Supreme Courts in the country. They raised $111 million, the most raised ever in an abortion rights state constitution campaign. They made over 1 million phone calls, and they did all of that by countering an opposition led by Governor DeSantis that saw police go to voters' homes and threaten them because they had signed the petition to get Amendment 4 on the ballot. There was litigation against the state that the campaign had to file because the TV stations that ran pro-Amendment 4 advertisements were threatened by the state for running those advertisements. And the federal judge who presided over that litigation actually said to, and I love this, I'm quoting, the federal judge actually wrote in the opinion, "I'm keeping it simple for the state of Florida. It's the First Amendment, stupid." Meaning that, of course, Amendment 4 had the right to put their commercials up on, broadcast and speak directly to folks in that state.
You mentioned that Nebraska didn't pass. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Nebraska had 2 competing ballot questions on abortion, right?
That's right. Advocates in Nebraska started a campaign to gather signatures almost 1 year ago. And as soon as they did that, opponents of abortion rights decided, they were also going to gather signatures. And so there have been a lot of allegations about some of the dirty tricks that the anti-rights folks utilized to gather their signatures. People have come forward in Nebraska saying, "I was told I was signing the abortion rights petition, but in fact, my signature is on the other one." There was litigation in the state. Both of the amendments qualified for the ballot. And as you say, the anti-rights amendment was successful and the pro-abortion rights amendment was not. There's a lot of research that looks at what happens when voters are presented with 2 conflicting ballot initiatives. Typically, it results in confusion, and it's really difficult for voters to kind of parse the language to understand what they're voting for and what they're voting against.
And so what does that mean for abortion rights in the state of Nebraska?
Unfortunately, what it means is that the current 12-week abortion ban that is being enforced and is currently a statute will be amended into the Nebraska Constitution. So going forward, if there is a legislature and a governor who want to liberalize abortion law in that state, they would need another constitutional change in order to allow for access after the first trimester.
And across the board, I guess, now that some of these ballot measures have been passed, how does this impact the overall kind of checkered map of abortion rights we have across the U.S. here?
There will absolutely be some changes based on these results. I mean, for one, hopefully the litigation that implements Amendment 3 in Missouri will mean that providers in that state start providing care again. when we look at the map of the country, right now, Missouri is kind of in that clump of states that are enforcing total abortion bans. So that will allow for greater access for adjoining states, for Iowa, where there's a 6-week ban, for Arkansas, where there's a total ban, for Oklahoma with a total ban, you know, for the part of, you know, Tennessee and Kentucky that touch Missouri. And we'll also see likely the 15-week ban that's being enforced in Arizona. We'll see implementation work to get that ban struck, which again will mean that in the western part of the country, there would be kind of a sea of access states: California, Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico. On the flip side, because Amendment 4 was unsuccessful in Florida, and again, I hate even saying that because 57% of people voting for something in any other world would mean that a majority had voted for the amendment and it would become law. And yet, because of the 60% threshold, Amendment 4 will not become law. Yeah. What I think that means for Florida is that the Florida legislature will probably pass a total abortion ban in the 2025 session. That could lead other Southeast states to follow suit. Right now, there's a 6-week ban in South Carolina. I think we'll see the South Carolina legislature pass a total ban in 2025 as well. So when we look at that clump of states with total bans, Missouri hopefully falls out of that clump, but we may see new states become part of it.
You know, given the outcome of the presidential election, and Republicans were able to flip the Senate, we still don't know exactly at the time of this conversation anyway where things land with the House, but they're gaining ground that makes it look like they could hold the House. You know, I've seen fears posted online and amongst friends that a federal abortion ban could be pursued if something like that were to be passed by Congress and signed by future President Donald Trump. How would that impact these new amendments in these states? Would these amendments protect against that ban, or would they be overridden by it?
I unfortunately only have bad news to report as an answer to this question. I want to start by saying that if a federal abortion ban is introduced in Congress, the Center for Reproductive Rights, all of our partners, would do everything possible to try to prevent such legislation from being passed by Congress. However, if legislation that created a federal ban was passed by Congress and was signed by President Trump next year or later in his term, we would also see litigation, right, around whether that ban met constitutional standards. If, though, a federal ban is passed and the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, after litigation that would probably take a couple of years, allows the ban to go into effect, then unfortunately, that ban would affect all of the states, including the states that have constitutional or statutory protection for abortion.
Okay, so if I'm thinking about it correctly, then the benefit of these amendments, if you're pro-abortion rights, is that in the future, it makes it harder for future state legislators to come in and pass restrictions on abortion rights, but it does not necessarily stop the federal government from passing overall restrictions.
That's right. That's right. As soon as the Dobbs decision was issued, we knew that we had to put as many protections in state law as possible, but we have a patchwork of access across the country because it's state law dependent. And you know, it's clear that what we need is a new federal right to access abortion. And unfortunately, with the elections, not only are we not going to get a new federal right, but we are going to have to defend against additional bans and restrictions.
Okay. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. Is there anything else on this subject that you just want to make sure people know?
Concerning the state constitutional amendments protecting abortion rights, I just want to say that now 11 state constitutions have or will be amended to explicitly protect abortion. And that has happened in, you know, basically two years. And that's an amazing kind of amazing statistic. This doesn't happen. State constitutions are not amended that quickly or at such a scale. And there have been some restrictive ballot initiatives on abortion that have been defeated. So today, abortion has won 14 times out of 17 times that it's been on the ballot. So I talk a lot about how the majority of Americans want abortion to be legal and accessible and support abortion rights and abortion access. Success 14 out of 17 times is just an incredible testament to how true that statement is and how the support for abortion is not just in coastal, quote unquote, blue states, right? But is in states known as red states, purple states, blue states. Folks across the country support abortion rights.
Elizabeth Smith is the director of state policy at the Center for Reproductive Rights, a legal advocacy organization working to advance reproductive rights worldwide, not just in the U.S. You can learn more about their work at reproductiverights.org. Elizabeth, thanks again.
Absolutely. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks to you for listening to 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcasts.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way, a nightmare down the hallway. I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells and little girl dreams. They said